we're discussing what resilience is, like sort of the definition. And there's probably a few out there, but you know, I think most people think of it as, you know, being able to withstand something, or right. And I guess part of it, of course, that is, but it's a lot more than that. It's not just surviving, it's surviving and thriving. You have to withstand, you have to have the coping mechanisms to withstand exposures to trauma or critical event, but then grow.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we got a big group today. Two in-house, Nick Norris, live from Zoom from wherever, I think some guitar place. Are you at a guitar center or something?
I'm in my business partner's studio. He plays guitars. I do not.
I was going to say, is your business partner Elvis Presley?
One would think.
Oh, he's that good, huh? Well, anyway, we're here today. Nick and I did a podcast previous to this episode. We discussed mental health and psychedelics and things like that. But we brought two additional people in who are doing great work here with law enforcement in the state of New Jersey. And again, I won't just go through everybody's bio because one, I don't have it in front of me. But two, I'll introduce everybody here and they can give a simple explanation of who they are and why they're here today. So we'll start with Nick Norris. Nick, you've been here before. Tell us again who you are and what you do.
Well, Nick Norris, I served in the SEAL teams for about 10 and a half years, transitioned out in 2013. And then I think most relevant to today, I sit on the board of directors for a nonprofit called Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions, which is one of the leaders right now in psychedelic research, political advocacy, and then providing direct grants to former special operations veterans to go seek psychedelic therapy. And then alongside that, kind of all of the support that goes around, goes alongside those sessions to help guys that are struggling with mental health.
Also, if anybody's forgotten, Nick really liked when people peed on him
Dennis. Dennis forced me to tell funny stories about being in Buds. And yes, when you're freezing cold, you don't really care what people do as long as it warms you up.
Oh, man. All right. Next up, we have Larissa Mason in the studio here with us. Larissa, tell us who you are, what you do, and about the first time you met me, too. Tell us about that.
I'm a clinical therapist. I'm a trauma specialist. I was trained out of Rutgers, where I taught on the graduate level, survivors of abuse and trauma. I ran a few different mental health facilities, and now I do complex trauma work, mostly with mostly cops, but a lot of first responders, veterans, and working on the resiliency level to get the mental health in the beginning of the training and the beginning of the career. So we're not just reactionary to mental health, but we understand some of the more preventative ways that we can manage it so we can avoid the crisis sometimes before it happens.
We met in Atlantic City at a dinner, and yes, I just said, please don't start fucking analyzing me while I'm trying to hang out, shoot the shit, and have a few cannolis.
Yes, you did.
We had cannolis, right, Billy? Didn't we have cannolis? So we did have cannolis. I talk about them a lot. People don't think I eat them like that. If you got a cannoli, I'm eating that shit, just so we're clear. Then we have Billy Mazur. He's the retired deputy chief. Can I say the PD? Are you
sure?
All right, from Atlantic City Police, New Jersey. What brings us all together is Billy has been a real staple for Josh Fidel. And if anybody is new to this podcast, Josh Fidel is a police officer in the state of New Jersey who about 5 or 6 years ago, I think now, was shot in the head, significantly injured, and survived in a botched armed robbery in Atlantic City. Was it in front of Caesars? Is that where it happened?
Correct.
Yeah, in front of Caesars. And Billy really took Josh under his wing and has done a lot for him. And Billy's doing a lot of great work for law enforcement in the state of New Jersey. So I'll let him elaborate on that a little bit. That's how we all came together. And I think you're Josh's, I can't say this, right? You're Josh's friend, correct?
I am Josh's friend, and he has given free and open permission to use his story. He really loves the resiliency aspect, obviously, from where he came from to where he is. So yes, we have free permission.
Okay. So can we say that you're Josh's therapist?
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. So she's Josh's therapist as well. So Billy, tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having us, first of all. That date was actually September 3rd, 2016.
So it was long, 7 years, yeah. Almost like 7.5 years.
A date I'll never forget, obviously.
Yeah, but, obviously, yeah.
So, I mean, prior to this, I guess I should go back there just for a little bit. A 25-year law enforcement veteran, second-generation cop. My father did 40 years on the job. My brother was on the job. My entire family was, I would say, dedicated to some level of public service, whether it was medicine, education, or public safety, law enforcement. So that's what I did previously. Retired in 2017, as you mentioned. And I was lucky enough to have an opportunity to, I was actually recruited by Acadia Healthcare to not only be hired by them, but help develop a national public outreach service for first responders. And simply to down to the nuts and bolts of it, what we do is we connect first responders and their family members with any behavioral health care needs that they might be seeking on the spectrum, whether it's, you know, the beginning entry level, like a counselor or a therapist, all the way up to outpatient, intensive outpatient, inpatient, residential care, and even acute stabilization, right? So that's for mental health, substance use, or the co-occurrence of those two issues. So that's what I do now, and I work for Acadia Healthcare.
Before we move on, how does that kind of service from Acadia work? Does it work for everybody? Do you need to have medical insurance? How is that available? And who is it available to?
Yeah, great question. So I will say this. I mean, Acadia is a for-profit company, right? So they are an insurance-centric model. That doesn't mean that we can't help people without insurance or Medicaid or Medicare. In fact, we do it practically every day. But our model is insurance-centric. It's focused on, you know, a first responder anywhere in the country, and actually in a lot of circumstances, anywhere in the world, they can contact us for free. It's an in-kind service, and we can ascertain their insurance, where they live, and we can verify their benefits and find them culturally competent care. Right? We're not a Google machine. We say this all the time. I mean, for God's sakes, you could do that. There would be no need for us if you just got on that and you Googled something. The way we work is through word of mouth. A big part of what we do is locating, interviewing, vetting culturally competent folks. So we can say when someone calls us, hey, I live in, North Dakota. Can you find me a trauma therapist? The answer is, yeah, we'll find you something. I mean, it may not be right there. It's based on, geographics, but there's never been a time, and I can say this, with high confidence, we have a 100% track rate, meaning there has never been a time where someone has called us and we were not able to find them an appropriate resource. And we are, over the last 5.5 years, we've made over 6,000 referrals of first responders. So our numbers speak for themselves. We have a huge team behind us. It's a team of about 80 people. It's the operations team of Acadia Healthcare. And we have tentacles everywhere. The outreach for them is just insane. What they can do, the resources, and that's how we're able to sort of stand out from the rest of the behavioral healthcare world in this specific lane because of the vast, options of resources.
How do they find that resource? Where can they find? What's the best way to go about? Somebody's listening to this podcast and says, I need somebody. Where do I go to find somebody? How can you guys help me?
Super simple. Helpingfirstresponders.com. And that first is a 1ST. So helpingfirst, 1ST, responders.com.
So where do we want to go with this? Where do we want to start with this cavalcade of people we have here? And how do we want to discuss some of the major issues that we face? So maybe you could shed some light, Nick, on some of the stuff that veterans have faced and some of the things that you're doing on your side of things.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of similarities between the veteran community and the first responder community. I mean, I grew up in the south side of Chicago. I have my whole family were firefighters. Some of my closest friends, I actually was just visiting with one of my closest friends is a Chicago police officer. And, we share these conversations all the time and the similarities are uncanny. I think in order to do our job, whether it be, in the military, law enforcement, fire department, I think we have an innate ability to compartmentalize emotion and do stuff that is extremely difficult, high stress, high stakes. And what I've seen in kind of exploring and unpacking kind of that compartmentalization and, you know, as guys are kind of healing, is that the ability to compartmentalize in that capacity really starts early in life. You know, it could have been early childhood stuff, you know, trauma, whether that be physical abuse, emotional abuse, a rough upbringing. And it typically, it, I mean, it's like a shared background we're finding out. You know, a lot of guys deal with that, and it kind of groomed them to compartmentalize well. And then they sought special operations in combat because they just excelled in that high stress scenario where, you know, that you had to kind of put your emotions aside. And that's a superpower when you're on the job. It turns out to be kryptonite when you step away from the job. And, you know, I always preach connection as like the strongest medicine, the thing that is going to kind of pull you out of the darkness. And frankly, when you're emotionally compartmentalized, it's hard to connect with people. When you're not connecting with people emotionally, you're not truly connecting at a deep level. And that depth of connection is something that, you know, I think is really, I mean, it's helped me personally. And the litany of friends that, you know, that I've gone through kind of all these different modalities to find health and healing again, it has really come through connection. So I preach that often. And whether it comes from, you know, a catalytic psychedelic experience, therapy alone, and I kind of always tie those two together because I'm a huge advocate of therapy and trauma trained and trauma informed therapist, because that's kind of the long path, right? You know, the psychedelic experience, which has been very, very successful in our community as a catalyst to open people's hearts and kind of decompartmentalize emotion and allow guys to be open and share and connect, leads to a healthy relationship with a therapist that can then take all that and start to unpack it, because there's a lot there that guys and gals carry from a career in service.
Yes, 100%. In fact, Bill and I were talking about this on the way up here to this podcast.
Exactly.
Because with good training, they teach you how to do the job well. And that job means compartmentalizing each situation, handling it so that you can handle the next situation with a fresh set of eyes. And you keep on doing that, and it's effective and it's efficient, and it allows you to be present in the moment. What they have not taught our men and women is the importance of decompartmentalizing at the end of the day. And so you will see somebody that is truly kick ass in their job, and they don't know how to sit down and watch a movie with their wife. They don't know how to not be anxious or read the crowd at a baseball game. And so their balance and their enjoyment, it gets, you know, sometimes overrun by some of the anxieties and the watchfulness that you need to have to be efficient on the job. So I agree with you 100%. I come from a long line of military, and I'm old enough that, you know, in my age, the men in my family, my father, both my grandparents, my uncles on both sides of my family, were taught how to be good soldiers, and then that's it. And so when that was done, what was left, and where is their identity, and how do they find that connection, which links into vulnerabilities? And so this is a really important conversation for us all to have, for sure.
What does decompartmentalization training look like?
Maybe therapy, maybe resiliency, maybe understanding it from the beginning. I think that there are plenty of people who believe that weakness is feeling sad or feeling afraid, and they're stoic and strong in the moment. But honoring the human nature of us, honoring, you know, that critical incident or what you saw or the child that you saw, you can't just pretend that's another Tuesday. That's not fair to your heart. That's not fair to your own children. And so, you know, the stoic nature wants to go home and say, it's fine. I'm home now. I'm safe now. Put it behind me. The day is over. But your heart, your head, your emotional makeup really needs to be able to process some of that. So you're not holding on to that. You hold on to that, it'll come out. You'll see me in an office 5 years later, 10 years later, maybe with a drinking problem, instead of like honoring it in the moment and going through that, you know, emotional experience.
Yeah, so, I couldn't agree more. Like the feeling, like sitting with feelings, if you want to simplify it for people that are listening, it's as simple as just being okay, feeling whatever you're feeling in the moment. And like, it's the opposite of what we've done for a career, right? We've suppressed that, that urge to cry or to get like, hey, we're pretty good with anger, because like you can usually use that as aggression in that, but still, you know, it's okay to kind of sit with anger and sadness and grief and feel all that stuff. And it's the one thing I've noticed. I mean, some of my close friends that have recently kind of gone through the psychedelic retreat experience and come out the other side, is they're like kind of weirded out by the fact that they're feeling for the first time in 30 years. And it gets mislabeled as like an anxiety attack or something weird like that, right? That has been labeled inappropriately by society as this like bad thing. And you know, unpacking it with some of those friends, I figure out, you're actually just feeling something. Like you're actually empathizing with somebody and you're trying, you actually feel for them. And it's just not something that we did readily for most of the time in service.
Yeah. So going back to what you said originally, Nick, about the, you know, sort of the crossover and some of the continuity between, you know, military and first responders, I can tell you some statistics that we've seen. About 30 to 40% of our clients that we see have military experience. They're either currently like Air Guard or something, or they had previous military experience. So a ton of crossover. Sort of the same personality, as you know, gets attracted to these things, right? Type A personality, helper mentality, you know, high speed in a lot of cases. So there's definitely a ton of crossover. The other thing that sort of aligns is the repetitive exposures to trauma. You know, in the military and a deployment, that can be in a condensed time frame, as obviously you know that. And although it's the same, it's repetitive exposures to trauma does the same thing to you neurobiologically. For a first responder, and let's say for the specifics of this podcast, you know, police officers, it can be more acute in a sense because it's so long. It's done over 20 or 30 years of this, right? And that's not saying it's worse than military. It's just a little different. It's just a nuance. It's a longer stretched out thing. So it's almost like the death of a thousand cuts, if you will. So there's that. Then the thing that you mentioned as well is this emotional detachment thing. And Larissa's not kidding. I mean, that was most of our conversation up here. We talked about three things that we refer to them as the big three. These are three things that it's prevalent in the first responder culture, but more so, more specifically to law enforcement. And those three things, they act as superpowers, like you said, while you're at work. And they translate into your life. We use a clinical term. We call it dog shit. That's how they translate into you. And those three things are emotional detachment, right? Cynicism and distrust, right? So if we take the first one, emotional detachment, you sort of alluded to it. You must develop a sense of stoicism, command presence. You have to take control of scenes, right? Dennis knows this. You go to a car wreck, and there happens to be three deceased people, two children and a parent. It's not your job to grieve. You know what your job is? Cordon off the scene, set up some flares. Let's start the report and figure out what happened here. That's what you're supposed to do, in effect, right? You go to a crime scene, right? It's not your job to be emotionally attached. It's to remove yourself from and do the job, right? So that's the first one. The second one, distrust, right? Distrust is a superpower of investigators, of interrogators. As cops, your job is actually to see through the bullshit that people are saying to you nonstop all day, every day. People are lying to your face. Why? To get out of trouble. I mean, that's just what happens. So in order to be a good cop, you must be able to see through that. And as soon as someone gives a statement to you, in your brain, you're trying to deconstruct it. You're trying to work backwards and poke a hole in the story, right? So that's another superpower. And then the cynicism, that's part of dark humor, is it not? I mean, we still have plenty of that. It's what we are. And so you're cynical of everyone and everything at work, and that keeps you sort of sane. But now think about how all of these things, how would they translate to your personal relationships, right? Your family, your neighbors, your social circles, right? You know, it just doesn't translate well. And if, like Larissa said, if there is not a mechanism to pump the brakes when you come home, figure out how to downregulate yourself, all this stuff seeps into your personal life. And there's generally not good outcomes when you don't have adaptive coping skills.
100%. I think so much of the training for cops and for military is physical, to run the mile, to maybe even to hit the weight, to hit the benchmark for whatever you need. And I haven't seen until now, and I've been doing this for probably 15 years or so, this is the first time I've even seen resiliency in police work the way that it is, because typically, historically, somebody like myself, somebody who works with cops on the job, I was used as a punishment. You know, you got involved in something, maybe you lost your job, go see psych, that's a problem. You want to get your gun back, that's a problem. So I think switching that also so that you see it as like working out, right? Like if you want to be healthy, you're going to the gym and that's a part of your lifestyle. Maybe you're eating clean and that's a part of your lifestyle. Being aware of healthy mental health should be part of the lifestyle. And I think historically we've kind of denied that in the ostrich effect of hoping if we ignore the fact that men have emotions or veterans have emotions, that maybe they don't actually have emotions. And, you know, that's a disservice to men who want to connect to other people around them. It's a disservice to the families they have, because they should be whole bodied self, right? Mind, body, and spirit.
No, I love it. You know, that's actually the dimension that I think most of, you know, our community is focused on right now is the mental, but not even the mental, the spiritual side of things too. And I think a lot of that starts to surface as you decompartmentalize and you become more emotionally vulnerable, right? So like, yeah, I spent most of my life training to go to BUDS, being a good SEAL, being a good leader in the teams, and I would say a majority of that was the physical, and then the ability to just kind of compartmentalize stress and just make good decisions. But like the ability, I focus on, you know, I meditate every single day. I have a contemplative practice, and I look at that as kind of exercising my resiliency and strengthening that to kind of create an environment where I can move my attention to things that are more positive, right? And I can be aware of things in my life or things that I'm doing that may be telltale signs that I'm slipping into a bad place. And I think that the ability to kind of grow that awareness is critical to avoiding, you know, kind of the really big pitfalls, right? Where people fall into suicidal ideations and social isolation. If you can start picking up on that stuff and you're self-aware, and other people around you that have been through similar situations are also not only self-aware, but they're aware of things that you're doing, you know, you can foster that connection and you can actually make that outreach to help your friends, because it's not always easy to see, right? If you're not self-aware yourself, then it's really hard to pick up on the cues that, you know, your buddy's putting out, because they can be subtle at times. And they're going to hide from a lot of it because of the way that we've stigmatized mental health. And to your point, you know, going to see the psych or the shrink at the command was not a good thing. You know, no one talked about it. I never would say a thing because it would make me not physically qualified to deploy and serve in combat with my friends that I've trained up with. So, It's bucking that trend and trying to kind of normalize it, which, you know, it should be normalized.
I would say, so again, going back to our conversation on the way up here, we were discussing what resilience is, like sort of the definition. And there's probably a few out there, but, you know, I think most people think of it as, you know, being able to withstand something, or right? And I guess part of it, of course, that is, but it's really a lot more than that. It's not just surviving, it's surviving and thriving. You have to withstand, you have to have the coping mechanisms to withstand exposures to trauma or critical event, but then grow after it, right? The post-traumatic growth, if you will, growing from the adversity. And you know, we talked about, you know, the definition of resiliency is it's really at its foundation, it is enhancing self-awareness, like you just said, understanding why you're even feeling what you're feeling. Because if you can't do that, you'll never be able to manage yourself. So really, resilience is self-awareness so you can better self-manage.
I think that's awesome. You put out so many good things that I'm gonna steal from you, and I'm gonna start preaching to some of my friends.
I got them from people who are way smarter than I did, so I stole them from them. So feel free to take them. There's one of them sitting next to me, way smarter.
I guess maybe I want to shift the question or the next question into something that has puzzled me a little bit. I've been trying to think about lately. I'm a big thinker. There's a thousand things that I ask questions about, but the other day I was having a conversation regarding alcohol, and I really don't believe, I could be wrong, that every cop, well, first of all, let's go back a little bit. We know that military, law enforcement, first responders, and alcohol are synonymous with each other. They go hand in hand. I would also think that alcohol is synonymous with a lot of organizations. Seems like people let their hair down and get really wild, or they're self-medicating, all these things. But specifically for us here, you know, why do you think, and maybe Larissa has a better question, answer to this, why do you think law enforcement officers indulge in alcohol in the way that they do? And I'm going to say this, I'm acknowledging that some of those people are using it to self-medicate, to try to find euphoria and relax themselves due to stress. But on the other side of things, when people think they don't have a problem because they're not self-medicating, why do you think that law enforcement officers and military members are drawn to the overconsumption of alcohol? And let's take out, before we talk about because they're depressed, because they're trying to self-medicate, I think there's this like type A personality thing associated with like this constant adrenaline rush they need and this constant party state. Why do you think that is?
That's a multifaceted answer.
I have time. I have time, Larissa.
so we can explore that. Number one, alcohol is very socially acceptable and marketed as such. And we are in a capitalist economy and we like to make money and all of that is good. So there is this kind of perception that alcohol is social and fun. And, you know, you don't see like the blackouts or the drunk driving or the sick at night. You only see like the ups and the positives. It's also a connection with other guys or gals, if you will, that you can have something to do together. If you just sit around the table and you're not having a drink and you're just looking at each other's eyes, like, this is awkward. I don't feel good about this. You have a couple of drinks and everybody kind of relaxes. And I think if we're not talking about the self-medicating, I'll bring this full circle to compartmentalization, because I think that for some people, when they're off the job, whether it's that night, that shift, whatever it is, that is when those thoughts start coming. And alcohol, even if it's not in the place where it's depressing your whole system just yet, which it is inherently, it's a disconnector. So you are disconnecting from the emotional experience you're having, which is why guys like it, because their thoughts stop racing or they don't have to think about the thing and they can be in the moment or fun or silly or talk about sometimes just back on the job. And then when you have that disconnection, if I'm feeling really anxious and I have a couple drinks, I'm drunk, I feel better, I'm not as anxious, I don't have to think about it until the next day, it feels self-rewarding. And then that's really kind of where it's easy to kind of start relying on that and go from alcohol use to abuse to dependence and grow into that addiction category.
I mean, I'm even watching more, like, you know, I still observe people and I'm like, man, even the more senior people, 20 years on the job, they're still doing the tailgate. They're still grabbing the kegs. They're still in the parking lots getting bombed. And again, maybe I'm doing a disservice saying it's just law enforcement. We know it's not, but this is cultural for law enforcement.
There you go. So I would say I'll offer you my non-clinical view of this, but it's an experience that I have, you know, speaking to people across the country every day. There's definitely a component of being socialized. I mean, just look at TV, right? So we learn this from a young age and it becomes ritualistic, like, mm-hmm. Hey, let's get a beer after work. It has a ritualistic component to it. And it's glamorized in movies. I mean, it's everywhere, right? So there's that. And the other thing I will say, and this is more of a this is more of a physiological thing. I think a lot of folks struggle with it, in my experience, from the clients that we see. With they think in their head it's a sleep aid, right? To downregulate, like Larissa said, you come home from work, especially if you work the night shift, really any shift, but particularly the night shift, and you're trying to turn it off, and you can't because your adrenaline. I mean, you're maybe stuck in that hypervigilance. You know, that area that's hypervigilance. You haven't gotten to that window of tolerance, which is between like hyper, hypo, and then the window of tolerance where you should live when you're not working. They think that it's going to put them to sleep. And it may initially, you're going to pass out and then talk to any sleep expert, right? Anybody who knows anything about sleep, right? It is the absolute worst thing you can do because it actually inhibits you from getting into deep REM sleep, restorative mm-hmm. sleep that heals the brain, right? Cognition, resets you. You just pass out, you wake up, you pass out, you wake up. Then the next day it's Groundhog's Day, right? Cognitive fog slows down your reaction. You just start all over. So the ritualistic, the socialist part of it, socialized part of it. And then I think the need in their mind to put their brain at rest to sleep. That's what I see.
So if they're using that, what's another solution? And then you're up, Nick. It's hard to read you on a 3 second.
Oh, no worries. I was the sleep thing. If you, there's a lot of people out there listening that, you know, might not be in a place where they're ready to kind of confront all their emotions and be emotionally vulnerable right now. But I can, so maybe that the ability to dissociate a little bit with alcohol is still of value to them, right? They, at least in their head. But if there's one reason to kind of check your alcohol, it's sleep. And here's something. If you're not getting that deep restful sleep, you're not going into deep sleep and REM sleep because of, and frankly, it can be one drink at night. You know, if you're drinking late at night and you're having one drink, you don't get that. And for men, and this is really important, like growth hormone, right? That is like indicative of the release of growth hormone is intimately connected with you being asleep and getting like deep sleep during that first section of rest. So like from like 9 p.m. till like 11 or midnight. And if you started drinking, you basically can have thrown your organic ability to produce growth hormone in the toilet. So, I mean, if there's one reason, you know, I would think a lot of the people out there listening, you know, are focused on trying to stay healthy, trying to stay young, trying to, you know, be able to lift more and run faster and all that. You're basically shooting yourself in the foot when you're using alcohol consistently. You just don't get that benefit.
Many clients we have, not everyday drinkers, but they drink to, in their eyes or in their mind, they drink to go to sleep. And it's just this process, like Nick explained and Larissa.
Just to comment on that, you know, I've often been criticized that, and it's well known in my social circles as a father. I have different social circles. I have ones in town where my children, other people's children are involved. And I have my personal life or my good friends, because I have some good friends there, but I'm saying like my 25, 30 year friends, 15 year friends, we go and do things, not as dads, but and it's not very often. And those people actually understand me a little bit more, but I'm often the outcast. And I always think about that thing that says alcohol is the only drug that if you refuse it, you're criticized. And, you know, often I will be asked like, how come you don't drink? How come you're not drinking with us? And I had an epiphany today. Yeah, it happens. What are you going to do, Nick? I'm not perfect. Contrary to popular belief, I'm not perfect, right? I had an epiphany today. I'm like, man, because we just came back from our conference last week, and it was inherently rough to run a 1,500-plus person conference, but then the siren called us from Broadway in Nashville, and everybody answered like the Greek sailors. And, you know, you end up there. We're having night events. People want to see me out. They expect to see me out. And, you know, you're out. You're like, I'll have one, two, three. The problem is it catches up quick when you're already sleep deprived. And it was really starting to make me feel like shit. And by Friday, I was basically a walking zombie. And I wasn't getting bombed. And then this week, I haven't touched alcohol in a week. And I feel amazing, dude. And I'm so thankful to be back to where I am. So that's why I don't like disturbing where I'm at now, my productivity level and my ability to engage with other human beings. But I also want to say that for the first time, like last year, we had a guy in here, Brad Wadaby, who is a resilience, you know, Brad, you're shaking your head. Yes.
Yeah.
I read body language too, therapist. All right. And, you know, I've never heard anybody explain alcohol to me like he did. And he said, the first time I touched it and ingested it, it was euphoric. When I was 14 years old, I had a beer at a party. I knew I was in love for the rest of my life. But for a guy like me, I don't understand that. But I also did abuse alcohol a lot as in my 20s. I really abused the shit out of alcohol. And I can go into details. It's not about me today, but I'm just saying I did abuse alcohol. So, you know, with that being said, maybe you guys can elaborate a little bit more about the detriment and where we're at. I don't want to disturb that.
Well, there's an interesting piece here that's kind of just being explored. You know, dopamine is our happy chemical, and we can associate that with anything, getting off shift, getting good food, whatever.
Sex,
absolutely, yeah. Right? Work hard, play hard, right?
Mm-hmm. Play hard, like literally as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think me and Billy are guys that like play hard when we have sex, yeah.
Well, that is up to the two of you.
Well, no, I'm saying not together. I'm saying with our partners.
Yeah, clarify.
For it to work, we'd have to play hard. Yeah, we'd have to play hard. Yeah.
Sorry.
There is this.
Sorry, Billy's wife.
There's this interesting piece of anticipation dopamine. So for somebody like Brad, who had this experience at 14 where it felt really good, that's almost some version of chasing the dragon. Mm-hmm. It's when you think about that, it makes you feel so good. Your brain releases dopamine in anticipation of that same experience. So it feels good just thinking about going for your next drink because you associate that with the relief of emotion. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole big connection in your body. When you're on alcohol, your body is wired to literally want more. Hence the, you know, dependence into addiction kind of category.
Food addiction, right? It says literally everything.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the alcohol thing, it's like the older I get, the less I'm intrigued by it. Yeah. You know, it's just, you know, I think all is younger guys and gals, you know, you're discovering yourself and, you know, through college or whatever it is, you know, in your younger years. So we all had those indiscretions, but I feel like the older I get, the less I am, you know, interested in it, because basically, you know, I see a lot of friends and I've seen the families and the relationships that it's destroyed. Mm-hmm. I friends that are, you know, my age that I know have, you know, they've indulged quite a bit, and I look at them now and you know, they've been through some rough stuff, you know, physically. Mm-hmm. Too, you know, their appearance. And so maybe a little bit of vanity is a good thing in this case, because, you know, you want to live longer, you want to be there for your family, you want to look decent. It's one of those things that me personally, and I'm not preaching to anybody, I still enjoy an occasional cocktail, but I just have less and less interest in it the older I get, because of, I realize now some of the physiological. And then I, of course, see all of the emotional fallout, the wreckage, and what this has done to so many clients. Honestly, if I'm speaking honest, that subconsciously sits with me too. So it's kind of, you know, it's one of those things that just makes you more aware, right? Self-awareness with it. So
here's an interesting thought. Smoking cigarettes used to be very, very common, right? And then we realized it gives people cancer. So historically, you'd have moms, good moms that love their kids, and they're in the car with their kids smoking a cigarette, or they got their baby on their hip smoking a cigarette. You fast forward with some science, with some understanding, not only do you not smoke in the car with your kids, smoking in general is seen very differently. You don't smoke in buildings anymore. You can't smoke 10 feet in front of buildings anymore. It's just different. We look at smoking as very different. It's not cool, right? It used to be smoked, paid per cigarette you smoked in a movie. There is a lot of conversation that we're going to look back at alcohol use similarly to cigarette use, where it was commonplace and used. And then as we learn what the real effects are, short-term and long-term, people are going to start making different choices for their health and wellness.
It's interesting.
And I'm sure, I don't know, I know you, because I think we talked about this before, just can't, especially if you want to get up and work out and feel good about yourself and be effective at work and help people. How can you do that with brain fog, right, Nick?
I can't, right, at this point. I mean, I'm 40, I'll be 42 this year. And like, I mean, I still want to be at my peak, and I have to work a lot harder, and I have to do everything humanly possible to stay at that level and have that edge. And, you know, frankly, I mean, I was habitually using alcohol throughout my time in the military, and then definitely afterwards, as I was I had transitioned and I was fully compartmentalized and dissociating by, you know, through work. And, you know, I mean, I will tell you, I went down, I took Ibogaine. I mean, and this would take the conversation in a totally different direction, but, you know, my experience with Ibogaine, which is one of the psychedelics that is being used a lot in our community, and for a number of reasons, not just from a psycho-spiritual standpoint, but from like a physical healing standpoint for brain trauma and concussive injury. I came out of that experience. I tried drinking and I couldn't, it tasted awful. It like literally eradicated my desire for alcohol. And I've been without alcohol for, I mean, heck, 3 years now. I've never felt better. I mean, it's amazing. I crave the clarity of mind and the way that I feel without it. And again, I'm not condemning it, and I'm not damning people that have, you know, use alcohol. I'm just telling you, like, I've been on both sides, and there's nothing like having the clarity that I have now. It's actually pretty amazing. And I need that now. I mean, being on this side of 40 and wanting to be a high performer, you know, I need to stack all the odds in my favor.
You know, it's funny you say this, and I brought this up on the podcast before. I don't know, 7-8 months ago, we had a family party, and my uncle, I think he's had been sober for like 40 years, right? So he actually, it's funny because the guy just did my barbecue at my house. I'm like, how do you know my aunt, my uncle? And I'm like, you know, because I'm like, how the fuck do you know that you're from here? They're from a whole other state. And he's like, oh, during the pandemic, we were doing this thing. And, you know, and I'm like, I wasn't even putting two and two together because I was in business mind. And he's like, I'm like, well, yeah, what is that thing you're doing? He's like, sobriety stuff. I'm like, oh, my bad. Right. Like, he's like, yeah, it's kind of supposed to be like a secret thing. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. He's like, no, it's not a big deal. I'm like, I didn't mean to fucking pry. But what happened through his earlier years of abuse of alcohol and narcotics, and I don't really have much context of what it was that he did, but bad enough where I've heard some stories like where he ended up in some situations and he had to leave the fucking state, like a whole cavalcade of things, but never in depth details. But from that point forward, 40 years of sobriety, my uncle is, what year are we in? 2023? He will be 73 this year.
Wow.
And I looked at him maybe 7-8 months ago at one of our cousin's first birthday parties. And I said to my wife, I said, Uncle Dick looks amazing, doesn't he? And she goes, your Uncle Dick is not allowed to have a lot of carbohydrates. He has almost no sugars because he damaged his body. And he hasn't had alcohol or drugs in 40 years. And I'm telling you, he looks like he's 57 years old and he's 73. This guy is, he is just, and it's like, and she said, I'll never forget it. It'll go something with me my whole life. She goes, and that's what you look like when you actually live your life correctly. That's what you should look like at 73. Mm. He looks fantastic. I'm telling you, see this guy, you wouldn't believe he's retired and then he's 73. He looks like he should be working on a lift somewhere, hammering nails onto a, I'm telling you, the guy, like, he's just, and he's crisp and sharp and like, bro, you would never know in a million years the guy was 73. In a million years. You would have no clue. You would guess probably 57. No bullshit. Hey, guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast, and it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally, and we also entertain you as well. So, you know, I have other questions on here if we're not going down the psychedelic route. And this is a good one, I think. And maybe we've talked about some of these things, but this is for Larissa and Billy. And then, you know, Nick certainly is the authority to comment on this stuff because it crosses over into his world as well. What are three common things you see most in your clientele? And how do you guide them? You can answer them one at a time. So maybe the most profound thing, maybe the most common thing you're seeing in first responders. We know compartmentalization for sure, but maybe we missed something there. Maybe something a little more specific.
I see a lot of anxious anger, which is something that's not really talked about. And we talk about anger. We talk about anger as a masking emotion. I think in the psychology world, we kind of know that anger and depression go hand in hand. But there's this other kind of piece where people identify as being angry, but don't necessarily identify the underlying anxiety. And it's almost like I can handle everything on the job, and then my kid gets a C on his test, and then I'm angry at that. And why am I so angry at that? Maybe because I want him to do better. But really, it's this ultimately potentially underlying anxiety that if your kid's not doing well, what does that mean about his ability to handle school? What does that mean about your ability to parent a kid effectively? And all of these bigger questions, which you have no control of in the moment, because here you have, you're dealing with the C. And so anger is the easiest one to come out with, and the easiest one, there's power in anger. It's motivating for people. So it's easily identifiable, especially in masculine kind of energies. And so really kind of identifying what anxiety is, it's not being scared and biting all your nails off in the corner of the room, but it's really, you know, what does it mean to have to pay attention to everything that moves when you're in a room? What does it mean that you can't sit with your back to the door, but that also means you're vigilant the whole entire dinner? And tying those into anxiety related pieces, because that translates into anger a lot. And I see that anger, I'll see cops. I have heard this so many times in marriage counseling. Larissa, I am so good with everybody else. I'm good with the brass. I'm good on the streets. I get accommodations. Why can I talk to everybody else, but it's my wife? She's the one that drives me crazy, or I can't handle it at home. And so there's an anxiety there with the element of a lack of control, because you're in a shared partner relationship and everything like that, that I think really needs to be addressed. And I think kind of humanized as manageable instead of its own problem, because it's not experiencing the emotion that's the problem. That's the human experience, the emotion, right? Happy, sad, angry, scared, all the millions of others. But it's how we manage it that gives us our competence, our emotional intelligence, our resiliency, and things like that. So maybe almost tying this into what do we do if we're not drinking? Look at how we're feeling and try to figure out how can we manage it without disconnecting, without punching a wall, without screaming at people. What does it mean to feel these things and not have control, or just be able to anger it away?
I mean,
anger it away. I kind of made that sentence up, but you got what I mean.
No, I get it. You know what? You're asking me. I'm not the fucking therapist here. I'm just the host of this goddamn thing with some thoughts and ideas. Good, Bill.
Yeah. So, man, I was just unpacking a lot in my head when you asked that question. She was talking. So here's what's pretty interesting. Just by sheer virtue of the role that we play nationally. So my counterpart, I need to mention him, not because he told me to, but it's important because he's an important part of the team. Joe Collins. Joe is my counterpart. He does exactly what I do on the Western side of the US. And Joe and I are a team. So we talk every day, multiple times a day. And it's so, we say this all the time. It's so, maybe ironic's not the right word, but it's interesting that you could take a person's name and geography, where they're at, you could take the fact pattern, and I could place it in literally Alaska, California, Miami, or Portland, Maine, and anywhere in between. Why? Because of the continuity of experience that cops are going through everywhere. They're all going through the same stuff, right? With the anti-law enforcement rhetoric over the last few years, you know, being targeted for all kinds of things, literally physically being targeted. So we're all sort of feeling the same thing. So there's a continuity in that in the experience. But going to the question more directly, what are we seeing? And I know you're going to agree with me because we've had this conversation. We see a lot of developmental trauma, childhood trauma of first responders. And a lot of times they don't even realize it. They've packed it away, with special forces, military folks. A lot of people 100%. Don't even realize the loss and you know, there's various levels of abuse, right? There's emotional, physical, sexual, there's all kinds of abuse, but there is definitely grief and loss, you know, losing someone really close to you and never really talking to anybody about that as a child, right? Or you know, growing up in an abusive household. I know Josh Vidal talks about this, and we're not sharing anything that he doesn't publicly, you know, abusive meaning watching domestic violence, right? But you just, that becomes your norm and you think it's normal until you realize it's not normal when you're an adult, right? So we see a lot of people with a ton of people with very high ACEs scores, adverse childhood experience, off the charts.
You're talking to one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just the reality.
Which normalizes the trauma itself, right?
Right. Exactly. So developmental trauma is huge. It actually draws people to helping professions like what we do. And then I say the last thing I would say is that's very common is the shame and stigma of actually admitting we're reaching out for help. But ironically, the most common thing that we get after somebody overcomes that shame and stigma and they actually get help, they speak to a professional, or if they go inpatient, the most common thing we hear is, I wish I wouldn't have waited so long. So there's that.
There's resources, and Billy gave you one earlier. We'll do that before we, you know, wrap this thing in a little bit. But, you know, you've got to take that first step. And unfortunately, I tell this to a lot of people, nobody's sending a lifeboat, right? But he kind of just threw you a little bit of a preserver. So grab it and try to find that resource. You got to make that call yourself. We can't come to your house. We don't know who you are. And nobody's going to come there and do the work for you. And that kind of leads me to my next question. And maybe all of you can chime in on this. I've often thought that low intelligence almost bred people with low emotional intelligence. However, recently, I've been surprised to find some people that are very highly intelligent with low emotional intelligence, which is very interesting to me because I always thought the two correlated. So tell me about how those two things, emotional intelligence versus, you know, intellectual intelligence, go back and forth.
That is right up my alley. Yeah. So our brain is kind of described as having both of those aspects, right? The intellectual intelligence at 2 + 2 = 4 and 7 + 7 = 14. And that's always going to be the way it is. And the emotional intelligence to know what we're feeling, how we express that feeling, how other people are going to take how we express that feeling. I might express it differently with my children than I do my husband or than I do at work and things like that. And ideally we're best functioning when we have that Venn diagram where they meet in the middle and you have the emotional experience connected with the intelligence to override it. Because if we're all just emotion, we're going to be very erratic and impulsive. And if we're all just intellectual, we're disconnected from other people. So we really need both. And you can have a high intellectual intelligence and a low emotional intelligence based on potential neglect scenarios where they weren't given, either shown the example or anything like that, given the way to understand how you feel. You know, children should be seen and not heard. That's shutting them up and putting them in the corner. That's not teaching any kind of emotional intelligence at all. Addiction stops emotional growth. So if you become an alcoholic at 21 and you get sober at 41, you are looking at a chronological 41-year-old adult, but with the emotional capacity of the 21-year-old they were when they started drinking, because in those 20 years, other people would figure, you know, social navigation, conflict resolution, growth and goal setting, and somebody else is just avoiding by drinking. I'm stressed. I don't want to pay the mortgage, so I'm drinking or I'm using. So they lack that social growth and the ability to navigate problems. Trauma also stunts emotional growth because they can get very stuck, even biologically, in the fight, flight, or freeze scenario. So there are a couple of things that stunt the emotional growth, but therapy can recoup those gaps. Therapy can help that 21-year-old reach that emotional equivalent of the chronological 41-year-old that I'm using in this example. So that's a big disconnect, is to understand how that emotional intelligence grows so that we can use both aspects. That's our well-rounded energy.
You could work on that too. Can't you work on becoming more emotionally intelligent?
Yes. Yes.
Goodness, yes. Goodness, yes.
Goodness, yes. I mean, they see me. No. By thinking in terms of balance, I think one of the biggest challenges I have with law enforcement and with veterans is because they've seen so many dark and traumatic things, they almost see that as their truth. So it's like, if it's a sunny day or a kid's birthday party, well, that's just a little thing, but they know like the real dark part of life. And so, when I ask somebody to do a breathing exercise or meditation or those kinds of things, it sometimes people feel like it's almost a waste of time. It doesn't take away the negative they've been through. And the idea is correct. Nothing takes away the negative we've been through, and nothing is going to stop more negative from happening. That's a universal life experience, is to overcome challenges to the best of our ability. But what I will say is that if you don't have emotional balance, if you don't allow yourself to see the light in others, to practice gratitude. I know this sounds so simple. I just came back from Mexico. Big problems, right? That's a nice problem to have. But you know, you can't turn on the drinking water. You have to brush your teeth with bottled water. The fact that I can put a cup under my fountain, I'm very grateful for that. So learning to look at the things that you're grateful for, learning to connect emotionally with other people, like you were saying, not just how's the weather, those kind of things do spark and grow and enhance emotional intelligence. Absolutely.
Very good.
I don't know if Nick had something, but I definitely have something. Nick, do you have
something? Go ahead.
Oh, So I think one of the biggest things from my own personal experience that definitely provided growth is learning, you know, the foundations of resilience, right? And one of those things is that I've learned through being, you know, going through the training, becoming an instructor, you know, working with professionals, the training that I get in this position is learning how trauma drives behavior for people, right? And when I grasp that concept, it made me see people and things in a different light. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really advantageous thing to be teaching police officers. And here's why. This is one of the things that always comes to mind for me. So trauma can really drive a person's life decisions, right? Which can lead them to do bad things. Now, I am not by any stretch giving somebody an excuse or a free pass. Some people need to be locked up, mm-hmm. okay? And there are bad people, right? I was a cop for 25 years, second generation. I understand law and order and its purpose. However, what I see differently now is it's just a little bit of a perspective change, because I can tell you, I've met, you know, thousands, literally thousands of addicts. I haven't met one that wanted to be addicted, mm-hmm. right? So what's driving that? It's something, some experience, some prior experience, some traumatic experience that has probably led them into self-harm or committing crimes, right? Again, it's not an excuse for somebody to sell drugs, do drugs, engage in prostitution, any of those things. But if you can understand and look at people, not like you feel sorry for them, just in an empathetic way, and think, I wonder what went on in their life to bring them to this place in their life. That's a huge thing. You know how trauma drives behavior.
So. I have a story that I'm going to just quickly correlate. And there was a paradigm shift in my life. I was processing growing. I've told the story in the podcast before. Just if you haven't heard those episodes, I'll reiterate it. And she had come on our radar. So just the talk of the police department. We're going to deal with this girl. If you see her, she's doing a lot of heroin, da-da-da. She's always involved, always involved. Now, when she gets arrested, I'm under the impression that she doesn't give anybody a hard time. So I end up, now it's like the seventh time, like 3 months later, she's arrested. Now it's my turn. I'm arresting her for possession of heroin or something like that, whatever it may be. Maybe she had warrants. So I bring her in and she was delightful. Looked very, for her age, the gauges, like the, you know, I'm not saying that's a quintessential picturesque abuser of heroin, but, you know, you could tell she's kind of living that life. And, you know, I said to her, I know your cousins. They're from town. I'm friends with your cousins. Well, you know, how did you end up on this path? You seem like you're so nice. And she said just that. She goes, I never wanted to be addicted to heroin. But my mother's boyfriend shot me up when I was 13. I've been addicted ever since. I go, what do you mean? Because I was stuck. He was my caretaker at the time. I was 13 and he stuck a syringe in my arm and injected me with heroin. And I haven't been able to kick it since. He was like 18 or 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And that's when I saw it all different. You know, I saw the mm-hmm. whole thing differently. And now I look at people and say, I wonder what got them here. I look at these people that I know that have significant drinking problems. And I actually said to one of our guys from this company who was going off the fucking deep end in Nashville, big time, a couple of them, but one I'm very, very, very emotionally connected with. I love the guy tremendously. And when I saw him on Thursday or Friday, I said, you're the only person I've had no judgment on how much they drank. And he said, why is that? I go, because I know that you're just suppressing trauma the whole week. How you behaved with alcohol. He's like, you know me well. I said, when I watch you drink and how you get, I know that's not a place of partying. I know where you're at. And this is a guy who's disclose a lot of personal information to me. And some of it's very scary. And I don't want to get too much into details so people might know who it is. But my heart goes out to him when I watch him. And people, I can hear people see him, da da da, this, that, these, da da da. He doesn't know what, you know. Yeah, no, I see him, but I don't see him like you see him. We see him differently. You see him on the surface. I know what's going on inside because he's a very, very close friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. Roger that. Point taken.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, if any of us out there are casting judgment against or towards people that are suffering in the throes of addiction, like they've missed the mark. Because I mean, that story, I mean, for me, I mean, that is like, that hits the nail on the head. You know, that little girl didn't have a choice. I mean, dude, I'll get emotional right now, man, because like the choice, she didn't have a choice in that matter, right? And then that decision for that individual to take that innocence away from her and thrust her into the darkness of addiction for the rest of her life and have to deal with the consequences that this country places on us. And like, hey, this is a law enforcement podcast, but I have a very strong opinion now, and I didn't have this opinion before, about how we treat people that are suffering from addiction, because there's a difference between somebody that is dealing with addiction and has ended up in prison because of some of the things they've done, and somebody that just chose to be, you know, they're a sociopath and they decided they wanted to harm, or they were taking advantage of other people because they wanted to better them or make their life better. But the people that are dealing with addiction, I mean, golly, like, I think we as a country could do a better job at trying to rehabilitate those type of people and give them the tools to try to deal with the trauma that led them down that path. And I don't know if there's an easy solution, man, but you hear a story like that and there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of them out there. Maybe it'll give people out there an opportunity just to kind of think about that a little bit more. And especially, you see people on the corner, right? People that are homeless that are sitting on the corner. I guarantee you, they don't want to be homeless and addicted to drugs. You know, they probably carry some heavy, heavy shit from their childhood. And again, not an excuse for behavior that harms other people, but a lot of those people are only harming themselves, you know? And that's the other thing, you know, we were talking about things that I see in my friends that are telltale signs, a lack of self-love. You know, we come from a community where we put ourselves last, you know, we always think about others. You know, our situation's never the worst. There's always somebody out there that needs more help and like, yeah, I'm not bad, don't worry about it. I see that over and over and over again, where people will, they will minimize their own struggles and their own suffering because it can never be as bad as somebody else's. And every time I hear that, I mean, the first thing I'll say is like, hey man, like there's no comparing, you know, your trauma or your struggles or your pain or your darkness. It's all darkness. It's all pain. It's all struggle. So like learning how to love and care for yourself and actually put yourself first for the first time in your life is probably one of the best things that I did for myself. And I know other friends of mine have done for them.
Everybody here is obviously involved in the mental health professional, I guess. Maybe even me in some sense, because a lot of our podcast episodes go down this road. You know, and I think that now, because of who I've become, and I think I use my brain a lot more in my late 30s into 40s, I find myself getting to very deep conversations with people very quickly. And then what happens is they pull back their lid and pour it all out. And I find myself becoming a therapist unexpectedly. I had no idea this was going on, but we're here. Let me sit in the mud with you and talk with you for a little bit. But, you know, again, I've been labeled that I'm a fixer. Typically, this is who we are as entrepreneurs. No question about it. We're all fixers. We all are in some sense fixers. But I'm also very much involved in the entrepreneurship community. I'm part of a mastermind group. I go spend time. I'm going to Greece with 35 entrepreneurs who are significantly more wealthy than I am. And I will be the poor guy there, and I'll just be asking for somebody to give me a ride in their helicopter or some shit like that. But one thing I find myself is getting frustrated. So as mental health professionals, we'll label everybody that across the board for the purpose of this conversation. Does it get difficult for you guys to get people to try to understand what you do? And how do you try to shine the light on people when they just, how are you not seeing these things? How are you involved in a relationship like this and you think it's okay? when 28 of your best friends are praying that you stop this behavior, disengage, move on. We see the beauty in you. How do you work through that? Maybe that's a good conversation for everybody to hear. So when somebody opens up to you, you know how to piece that together. That's something I never expected this would lead to. And I find myself in situations a lot that I'm ill-prepared for things like this. And I'm not the right person, but I certainly can't say to somebody, hey, listen, motherfucker, I'm not the right guy for this, right? I'm the right guy for, like, if you want me to show you how to, like, start a business, like, and like where you should do next and where you're at, you know, how to prioritize things. So I know that's a big, long, drawn out version of almost a simple question.
Well, I have a suggestion. And the idea is I just spoke with a cop this morning, and what they said to me was, how many people can I be? You know, I'm a cop, I'm a therapist, I'm a marriage counselor, I take care of their dog when it runs out. Like, how many people can I be? And I'm under the scrutiny for all of it. And there is a role for a therapist, and there's a role for a cop, and there's a role for all of us. One suggestion is, when someone is sharing pain with you, you're not their therapist. You're not supposed to be their therapist. That's not your role. That's not your training. And they don't need you as that. That's what the professional is for. But I have a fundamental core belief that healing starts when people bear witness. When they say that, I see your story, I believe that it's true for you, and I will share this space without anxiety, without criticism. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, you don't even have to say anything other than, I hear you, man. Like, I hear you, and I'm here with you.
Acknowledging it.
That's, and that alone gives so much strength, because, you know, people come to therapy. What are you going to do? You can't change the fact that I've been through a critical incident. Correct. I can't change that. But what we can do is work on how you're healing moving forward. And a lot of that is just bearing witness. If I may say one more thing, there is I'm social work trained, so I love the clinical psychology, but I do have a foundation in social work. And there's this concept of person in environment fit. So you see this person, the person that owns a helicopter, I bet you is going to have different therapy than the person that's been generational poor, inner city, things like that. They're going to have different ways of approaching, different ways of connecting. So you have to see that person in their set of circumstances, right? Because if I'm doing therapy with 10 people, it's not about me. It's not about my version of wellness or my version of marriage or my version of drinking. Where are you unhappy, and how do we change that? What do you want out of your life? And then that's where they go. And that's where that self-direction will help.
This helped me a lot because and I'm honored to be the person that I am today and wear the hat that I do. And as, you know, with all humility, a figure in law enforcement nationally. And I think people really do know through this podcast and through my other actions for 10 years that I am somebody you can come to, and somebody who is compassionate and empathetic. Mm-hmm. And I think that when somebody's looking for any kind of person to listen, and they know somebody's going to be pretty much non-judgmental from hearing podcasts like this, as soon as they see me, they get the beeline for me. And I always know who it is because I see them waiting around. When people shaking hands and saying goodbye, or they're waiting for this shit to clear out, and I know I see it coming a mile away. And so, you know, unfortunately, sometimes I don't have as much time as they need for me to be there for them. So how could I appropriately, like, let somebody know that, hey, I do care, I do hear you, but I have about 20 minutes left before I have to leave for my flight?
Literally just that.
That's usually what I say.
I'm listening, I care, I have 20 minutes. I add in gratitude, because I work with so much trauma that is my balance. So thank you for sharing. Thank you for opening up. And if you felt this was helpful, go find a professional or a friend or someone else that you can talk to, so that it's not that you're going to be the one to solve all the problems. You're a stepping stone on their path of wellness, and another person to say, I see your story and I don't judge you for it. I see a struggle and I see a person of worth. That alone gives a message. Mm-hmm. Not all of my therapy is big conversation. Sometimes I, especially with my kids or when I see children that are really in traumatizing homes, sometimes it's just validating their experience. And when somebody is dealing with trauma, you can have somebody very intelligent and they're struggling with what's real. What do they feel emotionally? How do they connect with others? And so when you're just validating their reality for what it is, that just goes really far for their own mental health journey.
So we do a lot of peer work, right? So, you know, we're very upfront and we say, hey, look, brother or sister, I'm not a clinician. I'm not a doc. I'm not here to diagnose you. I'm not here to judge you. What I am going to do is I'm going to listen, right? I'm going to listen and I'll share some of my experiences if you'd like to hear them, but I'm all ears and I can guarantee you that there is nothing that you're going to tell me that I haven't heard before. And we don't say that in a way where we're like, oh, we've heard it all before. Look how, you know, look how massive we, no, what we're saying is you're not alone, right? So that's why we've heard this before. So when we have these conversations, I mean, I we're very honored that, I mean, there's times where, you know, Larissa and many of the other clinicians and docs that I work with, they'll have a person and they'll say, call Bill or call Joe, and we'll act in a peer role. We're not there to be their life coach. I'm not there to convince anybody you need to go to treatment, right? It's not a role. It's there to be supportive and then sort of break down some of the walls, maybe ease some of the shame and stigma so they can get into see a professional, right? It's that stigma. They're afraid. It's the fear of the unknown. So we sort of ally a lot of those fears through peer work. And, you know, we're very successful because it's not about us. It's just, we're just being an ear, you know, for their voice. And not judging them. So
authenticity and compassion, it goes so, so far.
I have one last thing, I think, before we start moving forward with a conclusion here today. Why do people hate the truth?
Me? Because it's painful. People don't want to do things that are uncomfortable. We don't want to feel sad. We don't want to grieve our best friend from suicide. We don't want to grieve our neighbor's daughter. We don't want to feel depressed. We don't want to have missed the promotion. We don't like feeling those things. So we employ cognitive distortions. We minimize, we rationalize, we deny, we kind of allow it to be okay. And then in those places, we don't do well, right? If I'm rationalizing and denying, I'm not living up to being authentic or being responsible or being accountable. So the truth can be really hard. And I think, I mean, we have this beautiful idea, life, love, and the pursuit of happiness. And I want to be happy. And I would love everybody that listens to this podcast to be happy. But the truth of the matter is, like sadness, happiness is fleeting. It's a temporary state. And instead of looking for happiness, which ultimately is kind of a setup, I think we should just be looking for stability, for an internal sense of core and self and growth and love. And I think that's where we can honor our real truth, which, for the record, and this does tie in, includes making mistakes and loving yourself through it, which is really hard in a criminal world, in a law enforcement world, because, you know, it's action consequence, but including allowing your own personal growth and accepting yourself. It's called radical acceptance, knowing that mistakes are part of the learning curve. So that you're not in denial of what's happening and you have this kind of acceptance of what's going on. I think that's the best way that we can face our truth.
I probably wouldn't have understood most of this had I not gone through some of the most significant trauma of my life recently. So as you say that, and as I think I've probably gotten back into my head appropriately and with a clear sense of the world and understanding my emotions, I do a lot of reflection on how I was behaving and how I had almost no control over it. I in some weird way, I don't wish what I went through on anybody, but some of the blessing in disguise is now I can really understand what somebody's going through when they're experiencing trauma. And fortunately, some of the good things that have come out of that is my ability to help people, because it's a common traumatic problem that I went through, and more common than not, probably. And now I'm able to see it, recognize it. I even addressed it last night with somebody I know. I go, you know, you're in trauma. So the things you're saying to me, there's no judgment. You can say those things. I know what's coming out of your body. I know how you're trying to rationalize. I know your behavior and what you're saying. And you're a whirlwind here. You don't know what to do next. And what I can tell you is just, it's going to be okay. It's one foot in front of the other. And eventually you'll be sitting on the beach with me here. I went through the mangroves as well. But the beach is beautiful, and then there's a spot right next to you, right next to me here on the beach, and you're going to find your way through it too. And I'll be here when I'll give you a little guidance on how to get here. Just, I'm not your therapist. Just know that there is light at the end of the tunnel, even though you're deep in the darkness right now. And I just kept telling myself that the whole time that I went through what I went through, you know, and I was dumping it on everybody. Jesus Christ. I mean, literally anybody who would listen, I would just dump this stuff on them. Everybody here got it dumped on them. Literally every day I'd come in here and just dump all my trauma onto everybody nonstop. I couldn't do anything except try to express and get this stuff out. That's how I coped with it. You know,
one of the tremendous things about you, one of the things that makes you remarkable is exactly what you just said, the conversation you just had, the reality that you're providing for everyone. And when we grow, I really do think this kind of ties this all in, is we will experience trauma and we will feel a little broken, like going through a winter, right? Before spring and summer, where we start to thrive again. When we can make meaning of our pain, right? Which is, you know, you don't become a trauma therapist because everything's been rainbows and sunshine your whole life, right? So when you can make meaning of your pain and do that by helping others, it helps you heal, it helps them heal. And there's that growth. What is that? It's a force multiplier for good. That's what it is. Making meaning of your pain as you're moving forward and using it to help others.
I thought she was going to say what was remarkable was your impressive biceps.
But, I think we should, do we have a ruler here? I got a funny feeling, like a tape measure. Nick, I might be rocking 20s now. No, I'm pretty confident these are going to be 20. Because about 5 months ago, they were 19s. I think they're 20s. Now. I do a lot of work.
Listen, all seriousness, you have a platform now, obviously. This, the training, the voice, the circles of people that you're in now. So it's pretty impressive. That's a sign of personal growth. I mean, I wouldn't say it if it weren't true. I'm not giving you lip service, even though this is your podcast. But truthfully, I mean, the fact that you, the position you hold now, let's face it, I know you probably won't say it, but you're a little bit of a celebrity.
Little tongue in cheek.
You're a little bit of a celebrity. I mean, you are.
Yeah.
And for you to actually to humanize yourself and, you know, mm-hmm. come to somebody's level, I'm not saying down, but come to somebody, meet somebody where they're at and share that stuff. You can help a lot of people, just like Nick can with his former, you know, his stature and, you know, his achievements and the teams and everything. I mean, when you hear guys like you talk about these things, it absolutely gives hope for people. I see it every day. It's not some, like, you know, hocus pocus thing or some, you know, some goofy saying. It's true. When people, especially men who have some position or influence, can show a little bit of vulnerability and show their humanity, it actually can impact a lot of people. So, and that's really, you know, that's what peer support is at its core.
It actually has become my superpower where, you know, so I was telling somebody recently that I just met, I said, you know, it's kind of weird because they said, you can be anybody you want to be. I mean, literally 8 years, I was almost a nobody. Maybe a little bit of local known because I was a cop, but outside of that, and you know, now I have celebrities in my phone, and when they see me, they're more happy to see me than I'm to see them. And it's a weird feeling now, but I think that some of my superpower comes from my ability to understand them. And I think once you start getting recognized and experiencing, and it's a wonderful thing, nothing about it gets old. Taxing at times when there's 600 people who are in line trying to get a picture with you, which is fantastic. It is exhausting, but I never show that side of it because I know what it means to the other person on the other side to have that opportunity. But I get it more than ever now, and I know what you've been through, at least in the beginning stages. I have a friend of mine who was on here recently who struck a friendship with a guy who was on Shark Tank as a shark. Matt Higgins is a fantastic human being, and who would have ever thought that he checks in on me and says what's up every 7 to 10 days? I get a message from, hey, hope all is well, that it, I like, this guy's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, I actually wrote back to him yesterday, as weird as this is. I said, I think it's my turn to see how you've been. And we started chatting it up again. And it's comical. But one thing you learn about everybody is we're all just human beings, and everybody had a different path. And he's got a tough path. He had a tough path as well. And I think that we all see something in each other. And I think that's a beautiful thing to be able to do that. And I'm thankful that whatever I've been through has given me the ability to be that person for a lot of people. So I don't, Nick, say something good, huh?
No, yeah, I mean, yeah, you guys have said all the good stuff that I was gonna say. Just listen, you are, Dennis, you were saying, when people open up to you, you want to say that I'm not the right guy, but you are the right guy. And I say that in the most impactful resources And this isn't putting down therapists or professionals in any capacity, but it's the people, it's the normal person that is willing to listen to you and open up their heart and make themselves vulnerable, because they're the ones that, you know, are going to, I mean, that's where the connection is going to happen first, right? There's a lot of people that won't seek therapy because they're too scared. And just to be able to go and connect with somebody that is a friend and know that they have a friend there that cares about them is, I mean, that's like the first line of defense. I mean, that's where people are going to find their first bit of connection and hopefully start to pull themselves out of the darkness.
What he said just struck a chord, you know, in my head, a thought process. I talk to total strangers effectively every day from all over. I don't know these guys and girls. I mean, they're referred to me. I know they're, you know, part of an organization, and we start talking. We quickly, most of the time, vast majority of the time, establish a rapport like that. Not because I'm anything special. We shared experiences, and you can tell from the other line, mm-hmm. person on the other end, like they get it. Mm-hmm. I get what they're saying. They get what I'm saying. I can't tell you how many times, this is not because I'm so great at what I do, but I can't tell you how many times somebody has said to me, and it was just as recently as a couple of days ago, man, I feel so much better just talking to you. I'm like, well, if you feel better talking to me, you know how much better it's going to be when you talk to a professional that really, really can, you know, can unpack some of this stuff, right? Can peel back some of the layers, help you process it and actually heal from it. I mean, we just had a healthy conversation. That's all we did. And look how much better you feel. So imagine what it's going to be like when you actually put some work into this and you spend some time. It's rough. It's hard. That's why everybody doesn't do it or can't do it. But I guarantee you, if you put the time in, I know what's potentially on the other side for you, the outcome. I see it all the time. So sorry, I didn't mean to steal your time.
No, 100%. And tying into your genuine emotional connection with others, not to bring up something serious at the end of the podcast, but you know, one of the problems that we see, that we know that we're seeing with law enforcement, is suicidality. And I have had many cops that have told me that they were looking for what they call the courage to pull the trigger. The gun's already in their mouth, like the stereotype, but real life, just absolutely real life. And I'm looking at brokenhearted individuals. And the thing that strikes me now, and I have been doing this for a minute, when I first started doing therapy and trauma work 15 years ago, people were taught to assess suicidality on a scale of depression. How depressed do you look? How isolated are you? You know, did you dye your hair black? Are you, you know, all of those kinds of things. And I don't see that as much anymore. I see people, cops, who are engaged and who, you know, maybe like they go and spend time with their friends. Maybe they're not actually sharing how they feel, but they don't have any of those outward signs of depression. So when you're really connecting with someone, when you're really authentic with someone, that's where those emotions come out. And that's its own protective factor, because you may be more likely to say to a friend, listen, I've been really struggling today. I am not good, but I'm not telling the other 90 people in my life. And it's just that one moment. So, you know, we're so good at masking what we're struggling with. And I think that keeping those authentic connections are really what helps keep us well.
I just want to give one more piece of advice to anybody who is going to start therapy sessions. I think people are very, very guarded and stonewalling when they walk into a therapist session. But if you would like progress, you're going to have to probably, I guess, a session to learn to trust your therapist first. Because I've heard some horror stories, people getting very vulnerable very fast. And I don't want to dissuade you from going. The vulnerability and letting it down, let it go as much as you can will improve your progress very rapidly. So I was always proud, and I don't know if my therapist was blowing smoke at my ass. I have thus since broken off my therapy sessions. I don't go anymore because I do feel that I'm clear and resolved in what I needed to resolve at that time. I'm sure there's plenty of things I could work on, but it just wasn't feeling like it anymore for me. Like if I was going to CrossFit, I'm like, I like lifting weights more. I'm really been able to self-heal quite a bit and have some real thought behind and acknowledging my emotions, the people's emotions, how I'm making people feel. I'm into my own books. I'm in a book right now, and I'm sure you must know it. And I got to tell you, it's fantastic. I've given it to a few people, and I had no idea. They're gonna be like, hey, I just stopped everything else I was doing and got into this book. And I'm going to tell you what it is right now. But as I'm doing that, my point was, I was always tickled when my therapist said, you are my star pupil. When I tell you something, you're the only person that I see out of all these people that actually goes out and puts it to use immediately. And every week I'm excited to hear the report back on how it worked. And it's a big thing for me to you to be able to do that. And she goes, so you're very good at when I give you something, you're not fighting me on it. You employ it. But that's kind of how I live my life. I'm a meditator. People look at me. I'm growing a mohawk out now, right, for my Greece trip. People are often, you know, I'm a very abrasive Jersey, loud, funny, obscene, but people get very interested when they're like, man, you are fucking deep as shit. Like, I meditate twice a day. I work out. I have mindfulness. I try presence with my kids. I just saw something that, what was the actor who played the original Batman? Michael Keaton. There's a clip going on about him, and I loved it so much. It's like a TikTok clip or a viral clip on Instagram Reels. And he said, you'll never look back at time with your kids as wasted. So if you think it's wasted now, you'll never look back, because he's got to be 75, 80, you know, he's got to be older than 72, 73. He's up there. And here's a guy who was a Hollywood A-lister, still is. And basically his message was, don't ever think that your kids aren't the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And you'll never, I literally canceled like 4 podcasts or 5 podcasts. We had a whole thing to take my 2 middle ones to Florida with me to scout out our new conference location. And, you know, Frankie was like, you know, this guy's coming on and he's big. And I'm like, yeah, tell him we'll do it in a month and, or whatever he can again. I'm not going to SeaWorld and Universal with my 2 middle kids. And I got to tell you, Michael Keaton's right. I don't have a regret about it. You know, I just don't. I had a fantastic time bringing those two out, or like watching. It's like bringing a comedy duo out. They are the funniest 2 kids you'll ever see together. I said to my wife last night, I said, you know, who do you think the closest ones are? She goes, these two, you know, and then maybe this one and that one too. But these two are clearly the closest. They're fucking hysterical to bring out. They're redheads too. Comical. But let me give you the book. And it's, you'll probably know it when I just start to utter it a little bit. I have it on.
So type A personality is what you were talking about, right? I know Nick absolutely related to this. He's going to say Roger that in his head. But like, you know, type A personality is a lot of what you described, even in your therapy sessions, right? You're an action-oriented person. And so, you know, you can go in, the therapist can tell you what to do, and you're going to do it. It's just like you'll stick to a regimen of fasting. You'll stick to a regimen of working out twice a day, training, right? Meditation, all these things, because you know you have to break these things down into like micro goals to achieve the end, right? So you're very goal focused, goal oriented, and they are, you know, really a good profile for a person who's going to do really well in therapy and in treatment, right? They're going to follow through. It takes follow through. We always say that the sort of the cliche is, you know, recovering from trauma or addiction or whatever it is not a diet. It's a lifestyle. Right. So you're not going to go anywhere for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 30 days or 60 days and solve all your problems. You can get a fast track and head start into the right lane. But then there's work that continues. Right. And it's habit changing. It's creating new neural pathways to solve problems, personal problems. I appreciated what you said about, you know, the therapist gives you this and you go and do it. That's the therapist dream, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I know. I have friends outside of my therapist's office. I have friends that are therapists. Obviously, we're friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to hear the other side of things. And I know what therapists, maybe some of that actually played into my action. Probably not as much. And it's so funny because each therapist that I speak with all have compassion, but all have different styles and practices. That's why I tell people, you know, if you have the opportunity to shop therapists, see if you find somebody. Kathy, who's my therapist, who I've given a lot of recommendations of people to go to her, was a perfect fit for me. Just a perfect fit. She really was a good fit. And I had one before that. The woman meant well. I didn't give her enough to work with, or she couldn't pick up what was going on. She was really playing my cheerleader too much. And then the next one said, it's a shame that she didn't pick up on those other things that I see now. And she wasn't to her detriment, but the book is The Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents.
Oh, yes.
This is one of the best books. And if you're a parent, just read this. Like, I don't even think that you need to have had a bad childhood. This is making you a better parent. I'm understanding more of my kids. Now I'm a good dad. I'll actually say that I'm a great dad. I know I am because I try every day to be a great dad until I'm a great dad. I'm literally their friend. Like last night, like they make me chase them around at night to go to bed. It's hysterical. It's not like disrespectful. It's just the dad fun shit that we do at 9:30 at night. And the oldest, like the 7-year-old at the top of the stairs, he's like, "Good night, bitch." And dude, I'm dying. Like, but that's their connection with their father. They don't do that with their mother.
There's a level of comfort there. There's a level of comfort.
But they're not disrespectful to other people. It's only with their dad in the car. You know, and when they're with me, we're playing video games, the cursing starts, but that's their father's connection to them. That's how their dad's cool. They do respect me. This is not a disrespectful thing. My kids are some of the most well-behaved kids in the world, but when they're with their father, they know that they can curse and they're young and they let it rip. And it is, I can't stop laughing, but you know, and you can't stop.
It's a great thing. I share that my wife and I, and our three children who are, you know, almost practically adults now, we all have a little bit of a twisted sense of humor. So we laugh at the same stuff. I mean, the stuff that me and my son share on, you know, memes and stuff, or, you know, stuff I would most of the time share with my friends. I mean, it's just, it's good to have that connection.
Yeah, it
definitely is, for sure.
They listen to their father.
I have another book that I'd like to tell your folks about. It's called The Body Keeps the Score.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right? Bessel van der Kolk, he's like the godfather of trauma.
Yes.
I've read it, you know, probably half a dozen times, but it is very educational. It's something that I was introduced to right when I got into this profession, 2017. And it was such an eye-opener, and that was the trauma drives behavior type thing. And it's a tremendous book. Anybody I've ever said, hey, read this, they've read it and reread it. So that, I think that tells you something about it. I mean, my book is dog-eared, highlighted, and everything, you know.
If they read that one, anything by Gabor Mate, specifically The Myth of Normal, it would be a great follow-on. And Gabor references Body Piece Keeps a Score and a litany of other authors that are, so it's a good, it's another good, good, great compilation of trauma as a source of illness and addiction and all the other stuff. And it kind of ties in a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today. So it was recommended by a very good friend of mine that served in the SEAL teams that is deeply committed to building a network of trauma trained therapists for our community. And that was his latest recommendation. And it was one of the best books I've read recently.
Wow. Check that out.
I imagine the Gottman books must help you a lot.
I love John Gottman.
Yeah. So John Gottman, if you guys haven't, I'm going to tell you this right now. If you are in a shitty relationship on any level, just pick up the book. Anything John Gottman writes, he's a relationship expert. And I think that will help people see things a little more clearly from a very neutral position of, because you're looking at this thing going, either it's going to be really good or really bad, you know? So there's either going to be a lot of hope or some real realities and truths coming your way. And so Gottman's one of those books, and I'd suggest reading those as well. People are just like, listen, if you're a cop, throw it on an audiobook. I mean, I don't even read books. I'm audiobook all day. I have three different accounts. I have Playbooks, I have audible.com and audiobooks.com. Because I can't stop buying them. Once I hear about it, right, I'm just buying them. And I put them on the back burner. Then I'm like, on a plane, I'm tired. I'm like, well, I can't, this brain's not working anymore. This is a good thing to just listen to and relax. And then I'm like, but the adult parent book one is, I don't even think you need I think anybody who has a child needs to read that book. So you make sure you're not fucking your kid up, right? Because you don't realize how much you're fucking your kid up. And I watch it at these kids. I got to go to a baseball game tonight. Both of my kids are on a team. I watched my friends talking to their kids like, hey, what are you doing out there? Right? Like, hey, shut the fuck up. Like, they're 7, right? Like, they're supposed to enjoy this game. This isn't about your kid going to be playing first base for the fucking Mets. So, again, I don't want to make this about me. I'm just trying to correlate some of my life to some of the examples that we're giving here.
Completely relevant. Yeah. It's another part of our conversation on the way up. We were talking about coaching, and I spent a lot of time coaching. My eldest child is a boy, son. I coach 5 different sports in my community, one of them being wrestling. And look, I made a lot of mistakes. As a new dad, you know, you want your kid to achieve, and I cringe at some of the stuff that I used to say and that other parents used to say like trying to win and make them the best they could. And then I realized, you know, a long time ago, I didn't make too much damage between our relationship I realized, like, hey, this is not the right way. And there's actually a letter that was written. I can't remember the guy's name. You could Google it. I think it's called The Ride Home or The Long Ride Home. Basically, it was an op-ed piece. And I'm not sure if the guy was a therapist or he had a psychology background, but he basically talked about how damaging it could be to a child's mind when after the event that they've played or whatever the sport, that on the ride home, you want to critique their entire performance, right?
Right.
It is so damaging because you, and look, a lot of times it comes from a place of love, right? As a coach and a parent, right? You just want them to achieve, but you're applying your adult rationale, right? To a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old, right? And they don't think in that. They think about like, where are we going to get ice cream?
Right.
And so when I read that, it really hit me. I would encourage the listeners or the watchers, the viewers to check it out. I think it's called The Ride Home, but it's a conversation. It's very impactful about how not to do that and how to approach that discussion way, way after it, you know, and it should be more of an open-ended discussion, like, you know, the next day or 2 days later, like something like if they bring it up, hey, how did you feel about the other day's game? Is there any plays that you wish you would have done differently? Or is there anything, you know, what did you like that you did? Leave it at that. And most of the time they'll point out what they did wrong. So you don't even have to do it. It's a simple coaching sort of psychological approach, but critiquing kids after events and doing that stuff is like, it's very harmful psychologically. So, but I just thought of that.
You make me feel real good about how I behave.
Listen, I made all the mistakes, brother. That's how I know.
With these kids, I got to give credit to my wife, and she really has given me great guidance. I'm still not perfect, but I mean, every kid that comes off the field, I'm high. I don't care how they did. Hey, listen, man, I know you struck out, but that shit was good. I saw those swings were legit.
Yeah.
Right. You would have just connect. Next time you connect, it's no big deal. This is life. This is how you play the game. I'm telling that's 6-year olds this shit. Right. And I just like, you know, that's how I, you know, sometimes I let them acknowledge, you know, this one will say, well, I don't play as good as he does. And I go, well, that kid practices 15 times a day. Well, you're playing video. You know, you want to be better. You got to go outside and shoot. You can be that good. But that kid, I mean, there's kids now. My kid's 9, right? Now you got kids coming on the court and playing basketball. They're like fucking savages,
mm-hmm.
right? And these kids are, they'll probably kick my ass in basketball. He's like, well, that guy's really good. I'm like, he spends a lot of time practicing. That's what happens when you practice time in.
A lot of those kids get burned out, though, too.
Oh, I can see the parents behind them.
Get burned
That's
out.
Not them who love the sport. It's their fucking insecure father who had a shitty mm-hmm. childhood, who was never that kid. And I got to tell you, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu thing, although I know it's good, I acknowledge every single time I go that there's a piece of my childhood going there with them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think everybody has experiences with bullying. Not that I was bullied as a very popular kid, but, you know, I was a young kid in a very old neighborhood. So a lot of kids in my neighborhood were 2 years older than me. That was the crew. So, and I was also a boy amongst men at some point. So, you know, I was bullied by my father. Tremendous. My father is one of the worst bullies on earth. I told somebody that recently. I said, it's probably why I became a cop, is my father's bullying. Because I just didn't like, I'm very empathetic and compassionate to people who are victims. I was a victim my whole life. You know, my father was a horrific bully to all of us. And, you know, I don't think he acknowledged even, you know, unfortunately, the man has Alzheimer's. He's in the final stage of it. So I don't need to be taking shots at somebody who's sick. But the reality is this where it comes from? This is where that mentality comes from. So, but I, there is a piece of me that goes to BJJ with him every single time from my childhood.
Makes sense.
What else? Anything left we got, folks? This is a fun fucking time. We did,
man,
2 hours, which is typically an hour past. Nick, did you enjoy this?
I did. I appreciate everybody. I appreciate listening. I think that's when they came up. It's like we all can be better listeners. I just sat here and I listened a lot, and I appreciate all the work you guys are doing for law enforcement. I have a special place in my heart for the first responder community. I don't think that they get enough recognition. And our veterans have gotten a lot of support in recent years post 9/11, but our first responders are going out there every single day, and they live lives filled with trauma for 20, 30, 40 years. And I'm thankful for everything that you guys are doing to help them.
We're thankful for you saying that.
Because thank you,
that's,
man.
Yeah, that means a lot, dude. And I think that when people are listening to this program and hear stuff like that from people that they don't think they're going to hear it from, that means the world to them more than anything we've said today. No bullshit. Well, like my kids say, no,
it's
cap.
Sincere.
For sure.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Thanks for this opportunity, man. Seriously, we're self-proclaimed nerds when it comes to this. I mean, we could talk about this for hours on end, as I'm sure Nick could. So we appreciate the opportunity because we know you. Listen, man, you have a deep reach now. You have a large listenership. Your people are following what you're saying, and so we're very honored to be here. Truthfully, man, keep running.
All right, guys, that's it. Peace. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.